introduce Dr. Lu, who clearly all of you know perfectly well, Department of Community Health and Health Sciences and Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of UCLA. Of California, Los Angeles, School of Public Health and School of Medicine. And I am going to save the rest of the biography. Everybody knows Dr. Lu.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here and very honored to be invited by the Office of Minority Health to participate in this panel. I was asked to talk about developing the national agenda for research, practice, and policy to promote preconception health among minority women and men of childbearing age. Now, obviously, I can go in a lot of different directions with this talk. I can start by showing slides of racial ethnic disparities in preconception health behaviors, such as disparities in daily intake of folic acid or multivitamins. And then I can tell you that we need to study ethnic and cultural differences in preconception health knowledge, attitude, and behavior, and we need to do more preconception health education and promotion. But I won't do that. I can also start by showing you slides of racial and ethnic disparities in preconception health status, such as disparities in pre-pregnancy BMI. I can tell you that we need to better understand the biopsychosocial, social, and environmental influences on preconception health status, and that we need to do better in helping overweight and obese women achieve a healthier weight before they get pregnant. But I won't do that. Okay. I can also start by showing you slides of racial ethnic disparities in utilization of preconception care. And I can tell you that we need to study barriers and facilitators and work on improving access to preconception care among minority women and men of childbearing age. But I won't do that. Okay. I won't because you know all this already. Okay. And I won't also because I just want to challenge us to think more broadly about preconception health today. Okay. So let me start with the slide instead. All right. So when Dr. Neil Helfand and I introduced this idea back in 2003, we proposed that birth outcomes are the product of not only the 9 months of pregnancy, but also the entire the life course of the woman from conception onward leading up to the pregnancy. And so racial ethnic disparities in birth outcomes, therefore, are the consequences of not only differential exposures during those 9 months of pregnancy, but also differential health development across the entire life course. It's basically having different slopes on these developmental trajectories. Now, as you can see, we might be able to narrow the gap with prenatal care, but we sure aren't going to close the gap completely. I think the same could be said about preconception care. We might be able to narrow the gap even a little more with preconception care, but we still are not going to close the gap completely, not if preconception care is defined as a single visit a few months before a planned pregnancy, as it's often misconceived. Okay. Now, don't get me wrong. Okay. I'm not saying that preconception and prenatal care are not important. They are very important. But if we're ever going to close this disgraceful gap in birth outcomes, we're going to need to have a broader vision about the preconception health in this country. So let me talk about a national agenda for research, practice, and policy to promote preconception health among minority women and men of childbearing age from a life course perspective. So let's start with research. So if you think about it, the entire life course leading up to the pregnancy, that's preconception. And the entire life course leading up to the next pregnancy, including the interconception, that's also preconception. Now let's look at these arrows. Okay. Now we drew these downward arrows to represent risk factors pushing down on the trajectory, and we drew these upward arrows to represent protective factors pushing up on the trajectory. So the balance between these downward and upward arrows is what determines the slopes of that developmental trajectory. It's what determines your preconception health. So an important research question is, what are those risk and protective factors operating over the life course that produce this gap in preconception health? So my first research recommendation is that we need to study life course factors influencing disparities in preconception health. Now, as you all know, in real life, I think these trajectories are probably curves rather than straight lines. And that's because we now know that there are sensitive and critical periods during which one is most vulnerable to bad influences and during which one is most amenable to good influences. Again, when Dr. Halfon and I drew these curves in 2003, we said that these are totally hypothetical. Okay? That we really don't know when these sensitive or critical periods for development of reproductive potential actually take place, and I think we still don't. We hypothesize that maybe the fetal period, or 0 to 5, or puberty, or pregnancy may be such sensitive or critical periods because whenever cells are rapidly dividing and growing, they are most susceptible to stimuli or insults. And I think one such sensitive period that has been completely understudied is puberty. Now, Dr. David Barker and his colleagues found that the size of the mother's pelvis actually predicts her daughter's risk for breast or ovarian cancer. Okay. I'm going to say that again. Okay. The size of the mom's pelvis predicts the daughter's risk for breast or ovarian cancers. Okay. The greater the maternal pelvis, the greater the daughter's risk. Okay. They postulated that a large pelvis is a marker for high circulating levels of estrogen, which are established at puberty, persist throughout the reproductive life, and cause genetic instability in differentiating breast and ovarian cells in the female embryos. Okay, go on, leading on to causing breast and ovarian cancers later on in the life course. So the fetal origins of breast and ovarian cancers can now be traced back to the mother's puberty. Okay. And when you think of all the different environmental influences affecting girls' puberty today, especially amongst minority populations, this could get pretty worrisome. So my second recommendation is that we need to study sensitive and critical periods in the life course development of preconception health disparities. Speaking of reproductive potential, when this paper first came out, one of my students asked me, "So what do you mean by reproductive potential?" And I said, "I didn't know. Okay. I just wanted the y-axis to represent the potential to have a healthy pregnancy, much like the graph that you've all seen in terms of how the brain size or pulmonary function develops and declines over time. Okay. But unlike brain size or pulmonary function, we really don't know how to measure reproductive potential. Okay. So if a patient comes to my preconception care clinic at UCLA and asks me to check on her reproductive potential, okay, what tests could I order to see whether she's actually ready for a healthy pregnancy? We know that it probably has to do with a lot more than just the size of her uterus or ovaries. It probably has to do with the capacities of her neuroendocrine, immune, metabolic, and cardiovascular system to adapt to all the physiologic changes of pregnancy. So, for example, a healthy heart can handle the extra workload of a pregnancy, but a diseased heart can't. Or an efficient metabolic system can handle the insulin resistance of pregnancy, but a body that's already somewhat insulin resistant can't, leading to gestational diabetes during pregnancy. Okay. So reproductive potential has something to do with the body's capacities to adapt to the physiologic changes of pregnancy, which are developed over the life course. But that's still a very narrow view of preconception health, right? Because we all know that health is not just biological, physical health, but it's also that state of mental and social well-being. So preconception health has to do with the capacities to adapt not only to the physiologic changes of pregnancy, but all the mental and social changes that come with pregnancy. So I think our third research recommendation is that we really need to better define and measure preconception health. If we're going to be promoting preconception health, we really should know what that it is that we're trying to promote. Now, the same could be said about men. So how do you define and measure preconception health for men? How do we know that if a man is ready to make a healthy baby or to be a good father? Well, one thing we know is that men contribute about half of the baby's genetic materials, which are carrying their sperm DNA. Okay? And there's a growing list of environmental toxicants that could potentially damage the sperm DNA, and we know that damaged sperm DNA has been linked to infertility and subfertility, miscarriage, birth defects, and even some childhood cancers like leukemia. So preconception health for men has to be measured in part by their sperm quality. Okay? And since the average span of the sperm is between 42 to 76 days, okay, if you could just get men to behave, okay, take good care of themselves, okay, for about 2 to 3 months, okay, you could actually probably replace a lot of the damaged sperm with healthy sperm. Okay? And this is why even that one visit, okay, 2 to 3 months preconceptionally, can actually make a huge difference in terms of improving pregnancy outcomes. Okay? So that's why we're pushing this whole idea of preconception care for men. Okay? But let's think broadly. Okay? If that's the case, how does the life course model apply to the preconception health of a sperm? Okay? We know that there's been this very largely unexplained global decline in sperm count and quality, okay, across many continents over the past several decades. And we don't know what's really going on, okay, with that. Okay. Do hormonal influences, including exposures to endocrine disruptors in utero to a male fetus or during puberty, do anything to spermatogenesis later on in the life course? Okay. I think that's an important question from a life course perspective for us to understand about men's health. But again, I think that's a very narrow vision of preconception health for men, right? Just as women shouldn't be seen as reproductive vessels, okay, so I don't think men should be valued merely as sperm donors. Okay? So we know that men can play a very vital role in pregnancy, in parenting, partner support matters, father involvement matters. I have a student who's now currently doing her dissertation on the role of father absence in teen pregnancy. Okay. She's worked in Planned Parenthood for many years, and her observation is that a lot of these girls get pregnant because they were looking for love in all the wrong places. Okay. So she hypothesized that this probably has a lot to do with father involvement. Okay. Again, not the male partner involvement, but her father's involvement as she was growing up. Okay. Whether or not he was around, okay, how did he role model the relationship between men and women? Okay. And if her hypothesis is confirmed, it would suggest a very different approach to teen pregnancy prevention in this country. Right? So it's no longer just about contraceptive knowledge or access. It also has to deal with how boys become men, how men become fathers, okay, and what can we do better as a society to nurture the development of fatherhood over the life course. So a fourth recommendation is that we need to study men's preconception health. Study the life course influences on men's preconception health disparities. How do we improve not only their sperm quality, but their physical, mental, social readiness for pregnancy and parenting? So let me just say a word about practice and policy agendas for promoting preconception health among women and men of color. Much of the current practice agenda has focused on improving access to and defining the content of preconception care right here. Okay. And this is why I think I very much support the Office of Minority Health, Healthy Baby Begins With You project, because it's really trying to get the message earlier in the life course to college and high school students of color through peer education. But from a life course perspective, I think there's a lot more that we have to do. So for example, if we think that stress and allostatic low play a major role in pushing down the preconception health trajectories of girls and women of color, it would seem that one of the best things that we can do to promote preconception health is by giving girls and young women the resilience to withstand those the chronic stress. Right? And we in public health, I think, do a pretty good job in terms of teaching about nutrition and physical activities and getting people to quit smoking. I think we do a terrible job, just an awful job, in terms of helping our patients, our clients, cope with stress, giving them those resilience skills. And as an example, instead of simply screening, just kind of doing screening and referral for either peripartum depression or other DSM-IV diagnoses, I think we have an opportunity with the maternal, infant, and child home visiting programs. Okay? These home visiting nurses can be trained to teach family resilience skills. Okay? And I think that would probably have a greater impact on the overall health of the family than what's currently going on. Similarly, much of the practice recommendations of the Committee on Paternal Involvement for Pregnancy Outcomes have been focused on promoting father-friendly practices in the clinic and in the hospital. But while these are certainly very, very important, I think we need to be promoting fatherhood not only before, between, and during pregnancy, but really across the entire life course. So my fifth recommendation is that we need to work on identifying effective clinical and public health practices to promote preconception health, not only during preconception, but really across the entire life course. And then let me just conclude about a policy agenda. First of all, let me just applaud HH's adoption of the IOM committee's recommendation for clinical preventive service women, which include pre- and interconception care as part of the well woman's visit without copay. Okay. Now, right now, this is just required only of new health plans, but I think this really needs to become a national standard. And to improve access to preconception and interconception for low-income women, I think Medicaid really needs to adopt these services as part of its basic standard benefits. Again, while this is an important first step to comprehensive women's health care across the life course, I still don't think it's going to close the gap. Because as all of you know, improving preconception health will require more than improving their health development, but also their economic development, their educational development, and their community development. And much is what we're trying to do with the Best Baby Zones initiative that my colleagues and I have been launching, okay, to create those conditions in these communities in which all babies can be born healthy and all children can grow up thriving. That's how we're going to be able to close that gap in preconception health. So let me just leave you with a few of my favorite quotes. Oh, hold on. Policy agenda to promote preconception health equity should promote not only health development, but also educational, economic, community development across the life course. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results. We must become the change we want to see. And this one last one. For those of you who can't see in the back, it says, never ever think outside the box. That may be true if you're a cat, but if we really want to do something about closing that disgraceful gap in preconception health, we really got to start thinking outside the box. Thank you very much.